welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chops. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
I'd like to welcome you to episode 65 of the Carpcast. Officially, we could retire, Mark. Is that it?
65? Got some retirement plan in store so we can just go fishing all the time? Or do we have to carry on working?
It seems like there's a lot of fishing on the horizon for me. I'm actually going to go in the morning again. I've been blanking recently. I've been fishing church and cops, as I've said before. Got permission to fish the winter, and if it was last winter, I think I'd have had half the lake by now. Unfortunately, this winter, nothing's getting caught. Oh, that's my excuse anyway.
Yeah, nothing's getting caught anyway. I mean, I had a look earlier on what you mentioned to me about Simon Crowe's Twitter, how he mentioned it, and there's quite a lot of feedback from all over. And it's not just the odd person or the odd lake struggling to produce. It's pretty much nationwide. Have you got any theories on this, apart from just the seasonal cold?
Well, it's on the net, so it must be true. So let's refer to Crowe's post. Crowe's saying anyone else's lake's fishing crap at the minute. The waters I've been on have completely switched off. Worse than November, December for a long while. Jason's got involved, said the same thing. Worst autumn I've ever fished, and he's done a few. Crowe's saying he can't even catch from Emo at the minute, which I assume is Emmetland.
Crowe spanks that place usually.
Yeah, well, he says that's just not normal. So when, like, well-stocked runs waters are not doing fish, you know that there's something up. And there's obviously a lot of people discussing the reasons why.
Reasons or excuses?
Well, it's not excuses, is it? Like, as much as we joke, everywhere's fishing awful. And I think it's like we bypassed autumn. So we've had a weird year weather-wise. We had like the warmest winter in history last year. We had our first frost in bloody end of February. Then we had a really, really cold spring, like an extra cold spring. Then we went straight into like high 20s and the fish spawned. So it seemed to have gone from like, you know, frosty nights, minus twos and stuff, to the fish spawned within 2 days because it went super warm and they spawned straight away, which can't be good for the fish. Then we had a really hot summer, and then we bypassed autumn and it went to minus fives like within the space of a couple of weeks. The lake froze over on me last week while I was fishing, like, you know, 75% froze, which shows you how cold the water is. And it's, you know, that it was end of November. And, you know, last year we didn't get a frost for another 4 months after that. So it's been a weird year. And, you know, these four seasons of the year, the fish are kind of used to, and like bypassing spring, going from straight from winter to summer can't be good for the fish. And bypassing autumn, going straight from summer to freezing cold winter conditions, can't be good for them either. So maybe we've just had it good the last few years. I don't know, but it certainly seems to be shocking everything. I mean, it's been mild this last week and lakes still haven't really turned on. A couple of places have done a few fish because we've had some, like, you know, strong southerlies and 14 degrees in the day, 9-10 degrees at night. And I know Eric's Willows, which is quite a shallow lake, and all that did a few fish, but it hasn't really kicked. It just did a few bites where it has been crap. And that's about it. I've seen the odd catch report. But I don't know. Do you think I think it's just weather. I think the weather's been a bit weird this year.
Yeah, I think there's weather. I think with the rapid drop in temperature, the leaf litter gets mentioned. I don't know if it's not been able to break down as much, but just to completely go against everything we said, I've just had a text from the old mate Ed Betteridge. He's down on Monk's Pit and he's had six.
Wow, I saw his post earlier today saying he'd just got down on Monk's.
Yeah, he'd had six to £30. Wow. Jammy sod.
Wow, and that's literally just happened now, is it? Yeah, because he only got there today, didn't he?
today or yeah, I don't know if he got there yesterday, because I know Saturday night he was going out with some friends, and he said, his description, he said it was going to get a bit messy. He didn't know if he was going to get down there yesterday afternoon or this morning, but he's there now. He's had six. He's finished his text with, "You should be here," just to rub it in a bit. So yes, I'd love to be there right now, Ed. In fact, when we finished, I might just ring him up and not tell him I'm recording and get the lowdown.
Yeah, get him on. We've had Ed as a guest obviously once before. Interesting. One thing that is interesting is there's a few people on Crowe's thread saying that France is fishing pretty well.
I noticed that. I mean, it's how much of a different climate to us?
I mean, they do, yeah, but I mean, not hugely different to Essex where I've been fishing, so. I don't know. I mean, I'm going to go. Going to get there for first light in the morning. I want to go down and see Kevin before Christmas as well. Wish him a happy Christmas and stuff. So, I'm going through the motions as opposed to going expecting to catch something. Roger's just done a few days on there as well, and he blanked. He didn't really see anything till the last day, and then it wasn't anything really encouraging. You know, just sort of tail patterns and, you know, a dorsal fin out of the water. But the even the church light algaed up really late this year. Like very late, and it still hasn't cleared. And bearing in mind, like I say, we've had part frozen, you know, the water temperature's really cold, and it's still not clear. So it doesn't seem to have been really happy that late this year. Yeah, or certainly late in the year, which is
I'm sure with things in the past, Kev's got to be monitoring the church very closely with the algae still being there and having lost fish to an oxygen crash before.
Yeah, that was many years ago. I mean, you know, obviously he's had the pumps on until end of November, which is super late keep the pumps on. The copse is gin clear. That's completely clear. The copse, considering it's got like a fifth of the fish, has been more productive than the church over the last few weeks. But it's interesting. I'm hoping to see a change this week. I mean, you never know. I'm going down there fishing on the off chance of a bite, get three nights down there hopefully, but I'm not holding much hope out.
What tactics are you going to be hoping on then? I'm assuming with the cups being gin clear, it's a small lake, can you actually still see the carp where they are, or are they gone to ground?
Roger saw one sort of buried, generally we have seen them. I've been out in the boat baiting up when I've left and stuff a couple of times, and I've seen fish every time. Not looking particularly active this last two sessions. The time before, I saw half a dozen. Bear in mind, there ain't loads in there. I don't know how many, but certainly less than 20. Maybe a dozen. I actually don't know. They've certainly been quiet, but obviously conditions have been awful. They did perk up a bit this week, but rather than staying mild, it frosted over Saturday night and Sunday night as well. So it's not even like we've had a good week and a half of warm weather. Roger was taking the temperature every day. He said it was 7 degrees, and then in that mild weather, it did increase to 8, and then obviously it went cold, frosty again, and back down to 7. So it's not
fantastic.
The water
temperature, I take it.
Yeah. Yeah, the water temperature. So yeah, not fantastic. Not had enough. Sorry, go on.
Excuse me. Also, if it stays a constant, 7 or 8, you know, I'm sure they'll start moving. They'll start getting caught even in that cold.
Yeah, well,
be interesting too, because again, on Crowe's threads, oxygen levels get mentioned. It'll be interesting if all the variables are somewhere small like the cops actually get monitored and see if there's any relation to fish activity with the things that we can't see with the naked eye.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we've got it pretty comfy down there. When the church clears and we can get out on the boat and see spots on there, be able to see if the bait's going and stuff. And the fact that there's only really us fishing there at the minute, you know, we can get it. It's the perfect situation to be winter fishing. You know, we can bait spots, we can check spots in the boat, and there's decent, you know, we are fishing for the odd one slipping up, but the rewards could be, you know,
yeah, that odd one can be a 50.
Exactly. Can be massively rewarding, which is what you want. It's perfect for winter fishing, really.
Yeah. Just one last question. You say, the church has not really been doing much, but have the fish that have actually been caught, are they all in good condition? Are they up or down in weight? They're still feeding?
There's been nothing significant caught. I've had two and they've both been 20s. I don't really know. They're not sort of name fish that I would know the weight of.
The other explanation is there an explosion of naturals and they're gorging themselves on those and they're just not looking at our little round bowls?
Not sure. There's lots of silkweed about. There doesn't seem to be that much Canadian. It's all bottomweed, very silky stuff. But I'm guessing that's because of the light not penetrating the water. I don't know. Yeah. It's a bit of a weird one. I mean, if we'd have had permission to fish last winter, who knows what could have been caught. I fished twice, didn't I, on the cops, and had fish both times. You know, multiple bites both times. So I don't know. I mean, I did have three bites a few weeks ago. One out of the church, two out of the cops. So I don't know. We'll see. I'm going to go through the motion. I'm going to fish it as often as I can actually get out fishing through the winter, and hopefully we'll have something along the way. Not a lot been going on at Clearwater Fisheries either, which is Clearwater, our sponsor of the Carp Cast. It's a fantastic day ticket fishery and syndicate fishery up at Carnforth in Lancashire, and Alex, who owns it, is making one of the finest fisheries in the country. Yeah, definitely the northwest. The fish stockings have been going on. He's making a runs water, which I believe is Kellett's Lake. I think there's eight lakes on the complex. It's big pike and big carp in all of them, amongst other species. There's a fantastic cafe on site, does amazing food. And we're proud to have them as a sponsor of the Carpcast. Have a look on the Clearwater Fisheries Facebook page for up-to-date information. And our admin, Heapy Bob, is doing some work on the Clearwater page as well to keep you all informed of what's going on down there. We're going to be running some buy one, get one free offers in January. On Jimmy's Lakes as well, where we're going to issue a promotional code through the Carpcast, and that'll get you a day's free fishing for every day bought. There's going to be other monthly offers and stuff that we do as well. Maybe even give stuff like that, a free breakfast bar away before 48 hours fishing, stuff like that. So we've basically got loads of stuff that's going on. Clearwater also going to be at the Northern Angling Show, so you'll be able to come and have a look at their stand, have a chat with the lads that are running the lake, get some up to date information, and we're going to be doing a Carpcast social on there as well in the spring at some point. We've not totally finalised that date yet, but go and check out Clearwater Fisheries. You can get yourself down there for a day session over the winter. You can book a coaching session with me, because that's where I'm going to be doing some coaching for the few people that have inquired. Just go down and check out the cafe. Maybe if you just want somewhere to take the missus for a day out and stare at some water, maybe see some fish and get some really nice food, then Clearwater Fisheries at Carnforth, formerly Borwick Lakes, and keep your ears and eyes open on our Facebook pages and on the podcast for special offers, because we are going to be doing some such as the things that I just mentioned. And Alex is doing fantastic work down there, redeveloping the swims, planting loads of stuff, trees and shrubbery, and they've spent absolute fortunes on fish that are being stocked as we speak. Again, you can see the videos and pictures on the Facebook page, but yeah, there will be no finer fishery in the northwest than Clearwater Fisheries. You seen anything else on the net, Mark?
It's on the net, it must be true.
Oh, I've seen a couple of bits. I've seen it's that time of year. The sponsorship merry-go-round has started for the winter.
Yep.
And a couple of movements in Gaz Ferrum's joined Sticky Baits.
Has he really?
He has, yeah. So I wonder if Sticky are going to be doing Northern Specials now. Gaz Ferrum's thing.
He had his own Northern Specials. I mean, was he with another bait company before that?
Yeah, it's CC Moore who puts those out.
Of course, that's right.
I'm sure they still will under their own name. But the other one I've seen, Nigel Sharp joins Gardner.
Ah.
which makes sense. Obviously, Gardner's media man is Lewis Reed, you know, longtime friend of Nigel Sharp.
Yeah, Lewis has had a fantastic season. I mean, he was up for Carp Angler of the Year, and he's had an absolute kipper since, hasn't he?
Yeah, £54, wasn't it? Another welly whacker.
Another welly whacker, yeah. So I wonder if we'll get the weekly welly 50 throughout this winter. Not quite as good conditions as last year.
No. But no, if anyone's going to do it, welly will. Say that fast, welly will, welly will.
Well, pretty much everybody we've just mentioned has agreed to come on the Carpcast at some point. Lewis, I spoke to him over a year ago asking him if he'd be interested, and he said, yeah, if anybody wants to listen to me, do it. Obviously, he's had a fantastic year now to chat about, as well as all his old school stuff. Gaz Fairham also said he would come on the Carpcast at some point, so I need to stick him on my list actually and start chasing him down. And I know people have requested Nigel Sharp in the past as well, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. And look at his track record of fish. You know, it's, I won't say second to none, but it's up there with his good friend Terry Earn, with Dave Lane. He's, and his story and his capture of the Bergfield Common, it's got to be worth listening to.
Yes, certainly. We need to hunt these people down over the winter. Well, maybe they're not fishing quite as much. Then you know, maybe we can get... some of this. Somebody's tagged me in something on Facebook, and it is non-stop bleeping while I'm talking to you. It's driving me mad. Just let me turn off. Oh, it's Martin Clark. I've just interviewed Martin for the show. You're going to hear that interview shortly. Obviously, Martin's been pretty ill. He was rushed into hospital, the old blue light, to Harefield Hospital. And so I've turned off notifications now, and so obviously we wished him well, and in the meantime thought it'd be a good chance to track him down, and I just had an hour and a half with him, of which he's just made a post about, and now it's beeping like crazy because he tagged me in it. So I apologise if you're hearing loads of noises on the recording, which you probably will. But yeah, there's a nice interview of Martin. He's just put a post up asking for for any questions, because we chatted for an hour and a half, we hardly got through anything, and for some reason that hasn't turned the notifications off.
Yeah, you sometimes get that when, you know, you make notes for interviews and it just goes off on a tangent, you know, still about fishing obviously, and then, you know, you don't need your notes, the notes are just kind of there as a bit of a backup at times, aren't they, which I kind of like it like that, to be honest, when it just flows.
Yeah, and obviously filled us in all the details about his heart attack. It just made me realise that A, life's too short, and B, it could happen to any of us. He had no warning signs, nothing beforehand. And in fact, a mutual friend of ours who used to also fish Elstow from the Bedfordshire area. It was a friend of mine. Unfortunately died of a heart attack. He was not very old. I think he was like late 20s, 27, 28 or something. Again, playing with his kids on the couch 1 minute and excruciating pain the next, and dead shortly afterwards. So, a slim, healthy guy, as Martin said, he was, you know, he didn't think he had any health problems, thought he was fit, and just bang out the blue. So it's a message to us, to us all, you know, enjoy what we've got.
Definitely. Very pertinent message. It's also with my own health issues I've had over the years, something I can relate to myself. And just look after yourself, because we've got a damn sight more fish to catch. You don't want to shuffle off early when there's kippers still to be caught.
Exactly. Anything else on the merry-go-round, or is that it?
That's all I've seen on the merry-go-round, unless you want to make any predictions, place your bets, who's going to go where.
To be honest, I don't follow it. I don't know who's where. I did get my contract from Nash 15 years, or might be longer now. 15 years, I mean, I've been...
Oh, you'll be getting a gold watch soon.
Maybe. I'm just happy with some fishing on some of the finest lakes I could ever wish to fish this winter. And proud to call Kevin a friend, so it's good enough for me.
Yeah, can't fault you then. You've got to respect long-term loyalty, to be honest. But You've got a press release from Rob Yules today as well, haven't you?
Yeah, some good news on the angling front. Rob's, first of all, he's been promoting the On the Bank series on BT Sports that he sent me a promo video, which I've shared on my Facebook page. We'll get it up on the Carpcast one as well.
That's worth a look.
It certainly is. Yeah, it certainly is worth a look. I'm going to have to make a post in this thing. People keep tagging me, so although I've turned notifications off, everybody keeps mentioning me in the replies, and it just starts to beeping. So I apologise for all these noises that are coming. I can't turn Facebook off because there's stuff on Facebook that I need to talk about in a minute, so I'm using it for notes. Rob Hughes has been promoting the On the Bank. He sent me a trailer through by email earlier today. I've shared it on my page. We'll get it up on the Carpcast page shortly as well. Looks decent. I also found out today, I already have BT Sports on my Virgin Media package. It comes with Virgin Media, which is great for watching UFC and stuff, and obviously all these fishing programs. But I've just upgraded my iPhone with EE, and the new iPhone packages come with BT Sports app for free, so now I can watch UFC while I'm fishing. That's always put me off going fishing on a Saturday if there's a big UFC card on, but I can now actually watch it on the BT Sport app while I'm fishing. So yeah, if you're due an upgrade with EE, check it out, because I think they're giving away the BT Sports app with a lot of their packages. So make sure you chase them for that, or check it, or see if they can add it to your package, because yeah, being able to watch all these BT Sports programs on the bank and the UFC is fantastic, because there's tons of fishing stuff on there. So yeah, this press release is actually from the Angling Trust. It was on Angling Trust headed notepaper. So the Sport England report shows angling participation is on the increase. Latest government statistics show the angling participation has increased over the last 12 months as anglers head out on the bank more often. The active people survey is carried out by Sport England to establish how many people are participating in the sport. Survey looks at all sports, including angling, as part of the government drive to keep people engaged in sporting activity. 164,500 anglers were canvassed as part of the regular study to find out how often people go fishing and what is their background. For the past 2 years, the survey's release revealed that angling participation has been dropping, but an about turn this year has shown an uplift in the figures and the frequency that people are getting out there. We're really pleased the figures are on the up. Increased promotions, more awareness of the sport across national press and TV, improving facilities, good weather, plus a number of participation campaigns and initiatives are all contributing to the increase, announced Rob, promotions officer at the Angling Trust. God, people are still tagging me in Martin Clark stuff. I'm getting messages now. It's well proven that angling is great for mindfulness, health and well-being, and is quite simply just a brilliant thing to do. Getting out into nature and enjoying time in the outdoors free of hassle, stress, is clearly ticking more people's boxes. With increased competition for time across the whole spectrum of leisure and social activity, to see angling participation increasing is a great thing to see. Angling continues to be one of the largest participant sports in the UK, and it's a welcome sign to angling and government alike. There's a load of facts and figures showing the increase following a drop. So yeah, great news. Obviously, Rob has been a monthly participant in our show, and so we already know a lot of this stuff, don't we? He's been working hard through TV and media and his Sport England role and England manager and everything else. So we know all this anyway. Well done to Rob, and long may it continue. It's better for all of us, except for people moaning about too many people on the bank. But, you know, they're the miserable ones, I think. Anything to add to that, Mark?
Not really, but for everyone in fishing, it's good that numbers are on the up. I mean, we both work in the fishing industry, so it's always good.
Yeah, of course. Keep it going. Yeah, of course. So, yeah, well done, Rob. And I'm sure he'll have something to say on the subject next time we get him on. in a few weeks' time, no doubt. We've got quite a few bits to get through here. We're not going to dwell too long on us just because the interview's so long. There was something we left on a bit of a cliffhanger last week, wasn't there?
What was that?
Regarding spots.
Yeah, I thought he was going to mention the fact that I'd actually caught a carp. I thought that was the cliffhanger.
Oh, yeah. You caught one?
I went fishing and I caught a carp. It's quite shocking, actually. But yes, I went fishing. Nowhere's fishing good. I actually went down to the Carp Society show on Sunday, which it was good. It was quite busy. You know, I didn't spend too long there. Not as long as I'd have liked, but myself and Ray from LA Carp, we shot off down to Lake Two at Farlow's and raced against the darkness coming to get there and failed. So we went straight to the calf instead, as you do. But quite a long showy store. I set up in a nice little corner, and in the morning, one of the rods, it didn't really rattle off. It was a weird, stuttery sort of take, considering it was less than a rod length out in the margin, and had a pristine 22-pound common hanging on the end.
Nice.
So it was one of those weird fights as well. You know, you pick the rod up, and it's just like a tench shaking its head violently.
Yeah.
You know, there was no runs or anything. It was just hugged the bottom, charged up and down for a while. I'm thinking, nah, it's not a big one, it's a low double, because I don't think the average for the lake is much more than mid upper double. And you know, Ray walked into me swim just as it was ready for netting, and he scooped it up. But when you looked in the mouth of this fish, it was absolutely pristine. It was untouched,
really.
So I'm not sure if it was a recent stocky, because there has been a stocky in there. Well, it was a fish that just doesn't get caught a lot, which does happen in every lake. Even pressured day ticket lakes have fish that just don't see the bank from year to year.
Mm.
So, I don't know. It's probably just another stocky. I'm trying to make it sound better for myself. But no, I was happy to catch, because I fished the following night. I was joined by John Llewellyn, who was an absolute fountain of knowledge on bait and a really nice fella. And the temperatures dropped down to about -5, and it was very, very cold. Nothing else happened. But yes, I went fishing and I caught a carp. So
I've got something to live up to tomorrow then, when I go. You're probably not going to hear this podcast till while I'm fishing. I'm going to take all my editing gear with me and do it while I'm there. So yeah, although we're recording this on Monday, it's probably be Wednesday, I reckon, before you actually hear it. Give me a chance to get settled in on the lake, and then probably edit it on Wednesday, get it out Wednesday evening. But yeah, hopefully there will be carps to be had.
Yeah, looking for spots to fish.
Yeah, so having an interesting chat last week. Now the water's cleared on the Copse Lake. Been out in the boat and had a little look for spots. You know, is there any? Because we've been fishing it for a few weeks, maybe three sessions I've done on there, and you know, we found the spots that we've obviously found from the bank. Now the water's cleared. Martin Clark's just tagged me again. That was that beep that you would have probably heard. So I found a few other spots, and what we've noticed is some of the spots that we have been fishing and had a couple of bites of, that they've closed up a little bit, getting smaller. Now obviously that's carp not feeding on them as much. I had a chat with Alan. Well, what I've found is the spots that are definitely carp feeding spots, they're deeper than everything else. They've been cratered away, and there's a couple of spots on the side of the island. It's almost like a sheer drop off the side of the island where they've been feeding. Not around the rest of the island, just around like one side of it, where the fish have basically cratered it away. And in some case, they've actually bored it back, you know, like behind the island. They've actually cratered into the side of the island. So it's not just a sheer drop. It actually goes back in a little bit. Now, the fish have done this. Now, these lakes are clay. They're not gravel pits or anything, they're clay. So obviously clay is a softer substrate, especially underwater. But what I've noticed is all the spots that the fish have been feeding on, they're all a foot deeper than any other spot. Now, I know from when those lakes were dug 15, 20 years ago when Kevin dug them, they were dug fairly flat, well, extremely flat. I remember him telling me the story of the chap that dug them, you know, they'd been on it X amount of days. He was all proud of saying, come and look at this absolute dinner plate of a lake I've dug for you. And Nashie was like, no, you need to get the digger back out because it needs features. And, you know, they dug a few gullies and bars and whatever, you know, they just made some features on it so that it wasn't a completely flat, pristine thingy anyway. So I know that anything that you find that's out of the ordinary, that's, you know, a 4 or 2 foot crater, has been done by the fish because it was left pretty flat. They did put some feature in there, but, you know, they didn't dig holes. The carp have dug the holes, basically. And every feeding spot that I've found, it is like that. It's always deeper. It always seems to be, I don't know, maybe like a circular sort of clay spot that's maybe 4 foot circumference, like 4 foot round sort of thing. Not huge, just big enough to land on with the lead and get a little pullback before it hits into the weed, so you can just get some sort of skate. But when you see them in the boat, I've noticed that the spots are actually bigger than what you imagine them be. So, you know, if you're like, you're leading around amongst weed and then you get that drop and you think, oh, that felt clear, you know, it felt different, you didn't feel the soft land of like silkweed or whatever, and then you get a little pull off it. And then occasionally you'll find a spot within the spot where you find a couple of stones in it or whatever, where it's been cleaned down. And it really does smack down on that one little bit of the spot. Now, I picture that spot in my head being quite small. When I actually went out in the boat to have a look, these spots are, as I said, they're a good 4 foot from one side of it to the other, usually circular and yellow, so they're actually bigger than what you imagine. If you imagine a spot where you're underarming out say 4 rod lengths and then it smacks down and you just get a tiny little pull and then it's in weed again, like I'm picturing that spot in my head to be like, I don't know, bucket lid, a little bit bigger, whereas it's not, like it's, you know, nearly the length of me round, maybe even 5 foot round, you know, 5-6 foot close to being, and where I'm imagining it to be like bucket lid sized, but it's not. So it just goes to show what we actually find with the lead, and when you just get that little pullback and then it's in weed, it's probably bigger than what you actually think, which didn't surprise me. It seemed quite logical. It also tells me we miss a lot of spots when we lead around and underarm. It tells me we probably miss a hell of a lot. I learned something. But then I was chatting with Alan, telling him what I'd found. Alan obviously did quite a bit of fishing on there last year, and then, you know, mainly telling him about the craters, the spots they've been feeding on that are deeper. He found exactly the same last year, and he said he created one spot with himself by bait, you know, going down every day and tipping bait on the spot. And he said that created exactly the same thing. They, you know, they created it down quite severely, 2 foot deeper than everything around it. But he said the difference was when he stopped feeding it, the spot closed back up again. Whereas the other spots must be natural spots, i.e. there's something there the fish want all the time, because these other spots don't close up, whereas the spot that he made himself did close up. So that tells me that we can make a spot anywhere with bait, but the reason why the fish feed naturally where they feed is because there's obviously something there that they want, and they're the spots that don't close up. So have you ever had that, the mystery disappearing spot? Like it's there one week and it's not the next?
No, not really, to be honest, but I've not fished anywhere where you can, it's something I've, well, we know it happens, but it's not something I've come across. But it's probably because, like on Elstow 2, which is gin clear, you could see everything. You know, I didn't know carp holes back then. It's not what I was looking for. I was looking at the weed, looking for disturbances in the weed, not holes.
See, that was the first place I noticed feedy holes, was in that onion weed on Elstow 2. Just looked like carpet. So going round towards what was it called? Walk past the snag, swim up to the headland. That section of bank there, what I found was you could see these little depressions in the weed, and what I started doing was throwing hemp on them, and you come back a week later and all of a sudden there would be a hole, like a tiny hole, like, I don't know, size of your hand, a little bit bigger, but I knew that was where I'd put the hemp the week before.
Yeah, I used to call them tracks.
Exactly.
That's pretty much what they were. And you can also tell the difference after a while, because birds did it as well. But when the divers did it, it was kind of like a, well, like someone had stuck the PVA funnel tube down and just created a small dark hole. Whereas, you know, the carp, it was like just a depression, or in some cases where they'd absolutely rip the shit out of the bottom and just tore it up.
Yeah, I saw fish buried in that weed, because there was always bloodworm underneath the onion weed, wasn't there? So, you know, the fish...
Those bloodworm were the biggest, juiciest bloodworm I've ever seen. I could eat them myself. They're about an inch long and just really juicy red as this light on the front of my microphone. But yeah, I remember seeing the twin in there with its... It was kind of like on its side with the front third of its body under this weed, and it was violently shaking to, you know, get the presumably the bloodworm underneath. And it was interesting to see. You know, I've also watched that same fish absolutely bounce onto the bottom and it's with its body and then swim, you know, foot or two off the bottom, sucking all the particles from midwater.
Yeah. So just interesting, you know, the natural spots, they are there because, you know, they're there because there must be something in the substrate that the fish want, whether it be bloodworm or some sort of natural stuff or salt or who knows. But those spots don't, you know, you must have seen them blatant spots on lakes that are just always there, and the fish still keep getting caught off those blatant spots. Well, I would always avoid the blatant spots, and then somebody else would go and have a hit off him, and I'd think, well, you know, I'm always looking for them. Something a little bit different. But at the end of the day, the reason why the blatant spots are blatant is because either A, the anglers fish them and keep the food going on them all the time, or B, the fish created them with, because there's something natural there that they want, and they're going to keep feeding off them. I mean, it's nice when you find a new spot, a spot that didn't used to be there, and all of a sudden the fish have made it. Because they're the banker spots, aren't they? If you can get onto it, you know, when I've done boat fishing, you could tell the difference between the ones that have been hammered and the new ones. Remember when I first started fishing Fendrate in the spring, when you could actually see the bottom? You know, chatted to Gary Bays about this a lot. And, you know, they'd like work an area of the lake, and you could tell if a spot had been hammered or not, because the stones used to like shine a little bit more, and the ones that had like been freshly done, and you always wanted like the fresh ones as opposed to the ones that have been done a little while. Then obviously, I don't know if they'd like do all the spots in one area and then they'd move to another area of the lake, and I'm sure they're just like depleting whatever's there, and then obviously it probably takes months for it to all, you know, regenerate, and then they might go back and do that area again. But you know, if you could find like a nice new spot that the fish had just started working, I mean, that was always guarantee your bites. But you know, how you do that with a marker float when you can't boat fish is obviously really, it's a really fine-tuned science. So I learned a lot last week, even though, you know, blanked. I definitely came away like just picturing what we find with the marker float. I was picturing it a lot better in my head, you know, from, and considering I thought the spot was tiny, one of these spots, and I saw it in the boat, and like I say, it's probably 4, 5, 6 foot round, something like that, you know, and I'm just literally getting a donk down on it and one little pull, and then thinking that's weed, thinking it's a tiny spot, and it ain't. And we definitely miss a lot of spots when we're leading around, without doubt.
Yeah. So excuse me, saying all that, do you think the man who's pulling his marker float back and he finds that little depression, that carp hole, and he fishes that, he's going to be more successful than the man who pulls his marker float to the top of a bar or a plateau?
Well, bars and plateaus are naturally forming, but it doesn't necessarily mean they've got food on them. I mean, fish definitely use them as patrol routes, and they're good places to ambush fish. I mean, I haven't fished a lake for years. You know, anyone who fishes this sort of Colne Valley gravel pits will be used to this, but quite often you've got like three bars in a line, you know, and in the mornings they'd be on the near bar, and in the evenings they might be on the far bar. And you know how I used, it was two rods back in those days, it was sort of in the late 80s, early 90s, I was fishing around there a lot. I remember fine-tuning them, you know, there was one, there was a short bar really close in, and I would always get a bite at 9 a.m. on that bar, And yet that was the only time I would ever catch off the near bar. It'd always be off one of the other bars, but you could, it was only two rods then, so you know, you'd only learn that by fishing one rod in the gully between one bar and one rod in the gully between the next bar, and you know, seeing which one goes, and then if it goes, you'd put all your rods in that bar. But when you only had two rods to work with, it's not quite as easy. But I don't know, I mean, learning patrol routes is a different question. They definitely use features for control for patrol routes, so you know, I'm always happy fishing near bars and near plateaus, but I'm talking about feeding spots, which is obviously different.
Yeah, I'm thinking like, so what's Swan Lake and on Bluebell, you had a couple of sessions on there. It's not, you fished it as well, it's not overly featured. No, you know, quite you know, deep, and well, to the feel of the marker float, it feels quite too flat, but I'm sure if you drain it down there, it'd be different. But yeah, if you could find one of those carpy holes down in there, you know, because it's a pressured, you know, paranoid fish venue, you know, you could really give it a good spanking. You know, I dare say, yeah, a lot of Cromwell would be the same as well, even though that does have one or two humps and bumps in there.
Well, we quite often look for shallower areas than deeper areas, don't we?
Oh, 100%.
But I remember fishing Wire Lake a long, long time ago. Did a winter on there 15, 16 years ago. I was the only person fishing all winter. I fished virtually six nights a week on there. I hardcored it. It was in super keen stages, and you know, that was where I fished. Anyway, there was a spot off the point swim that's only about 30, 35 yards out. It's pre-wrap day, so I couldn't tell you exactly where it is, but I know roughly. It was like, for anyone fishing the point swim on Wire Lake, it was at about 11 o'clock, straight out, so you know, slightly left. It was about 30 yards, 35 paces, something like that. I used to pace my rods out in those days. And it was definitely a foot and a half to 2 foot deeper than everything around it. And that used to be a banker spot for me. I only had two fish that winter in about 60 nights fishing, and they were both off that spot. And that, you know, I had the lake to myself. I was baiting all over and, you know, trying to get stuff going. And it is a known spot, but again, it's obviously a feeding spot because it was deeper than everything around it. You know, and the fish have done that without doubt. So yeah, I learned something last week, even after 35 years carp fishing.
We're always learning. But I've got a question for you now. Do you own a GoPro?
Yes.
The Copse Lake is gin clear.
Yes.
You know what I'm going to tell you to do now, don't you?
Stick that out. That would enable me having to work out how to use it.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you've got, if you're down at Nash HQ, you've got Ollie or Carl and Alex, whoever's around there, they'll point you in the right track, being an old technophobe.
Yeah.
He says, when you sat down with all your recording equipment surrounding you.
I'm good with equipment. I don't know why I've never really learned how to use my GoPro. Yeah. I bought it and I've not really used it since. But I lent it to the missus and the sister who went to America last year. But I'm sure it's back on our shelf. So, yeah, good shout.
Yeah, take that down, just get a few shots, even like a video drifting over them. Then, we can all put images into our words.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. But deeper spots, I'm definitely looking for depressions now. With the marker float, yeah, definitely. And it was when Drew was fishing with us as well, with his bait boat. He had a bait boat and echo sounder, and on a different lake. But just seeing there, you know, if it just drops down a foot for no apparent reason, well, it's not no apparent reason. I'm sure the fish doing that now. I really am. So yeah, interesting. Anyway, be interested in other people's thoughts on spots like that. Two things there, really. One, you know, the carp tend to crater them down deeper. You must have seen on that. You've seen Simon Scott's netting videos and stuff, haven't you? Where they're draining down lakes. You know, they call them carp holes, don't they? Which are you know, big, sort of 2 foot deeper holes where the fish have just fed in. And there must be a reason. There must be something natural that's making them do that in that area as opposed to another area. And we can do it ourselves with bait. We know that. But it's just the fact that they stay there and our ones vanish once the food's gone.
Interesting thing. So the key to utilise them to our best abilities is to find the ones that the carp have made and don't tell anyone.
Yeah, save the fortune on bait.
Yeah, just fishing with singles. Oh, yeah. That's my dream season, that.
Yeah, singles. Yeah, anyway. Cletus. Go on.
Yeah, a couple of listeners' questions you just started. Cletus, a regular, a good lad. He also gives us diet tips.
Ask us a question.
He says, what time of the year are carp at their most hungry? And why do they seem to put on heavy weights in the winter when there's usually less anglers and less bait being used?
I can answer that one fairly easily. Because they... Who was it who told us? Was it Simon Scott? They basically gather spawn again at that time of year. They, when those fish are getting bigger, it's not just eating, it's not just food. They are creating eggs.
I do remember it now you've mentioned it. Yes, it was definitely the Simon Scott chat. I don't know if it was part one or part two, so I think everyone should go back and listen to them both.
Yeah, certainly. obviously, the two biggest times of year, if we get a mild winter, the biggest weights are always November and December. And then, obviously, springtime, just prior to spawning, end of May, tend to be at their biggest, and I don't think it's too much to do with food. I used to think that winter feed was them putting on the weight, the big winter weights were them putting on the weight by eating. They basically put on what they lose from spawn, but we were corrected, weren't we, by Simon Scott. It's not, it's a new load of eggs.
Yeah, definitely. If I remember a fish that we both caught, I had it spawned out and you had it 3 months later in the autumn. It was 12 pound heavier, a fish that we shall not name.
No, the unnamed one. Cletus makes some interesting observations. He's saying, why do they gain weights in winter when there's usually less angler's bait being used? There's a lot more naturals around in winter than you imagine as well. I found it this year. There's still hatches that hatch in November and December. Yes, there is less bait going in. I don't think the fish move as fast when the water's colder, so they're not burning as much energy as well. I don't think they're using as much, but yeah, I think Simon Scott said it's generally a new load of eggs. Something else to tell you about is the VIP carp holidays. It's filling up fast now. You can give us a call. Oh, vipcarpholidays.com is the website. July and August is now full. In fact, we could have sold it three times over for the Riverlock Paradise, but that's a completely different holiday to the norm. If you fancy a family holiday right in the south of France, something that's different to a commercial French lake, then how about your own private stretch of the Riverlock? It is absolute paradise. There's all sorts of species down there. Catfish to £100, carp to £60, zander, perch, pike. There's absolutely everything. There's table tennis table, there's a private swimming pool, it's a villa that can sleep eight people. You probably get a couple more there with a couple of you sleeping on the private bank, which is basically in the garden. There is no more perfect place for a family holiday, and it's just a bit different. It's in a non-flood zone as well, so you can be safe that you're booking in advance and still going to be able to fish whatever the conditions. Jim Lightfoot, who owns the place, fantastic foreign angler, knows all the stuff. He can help you as well. If you've never fished a river before, don't be put off. He's got all the answers and all the tactics. The fish, now he's owned it a few months and there's bait going in regularly. The fish are getting caught regularly. He's been down there decorating this weekend and he's had, I think he had two and lost one. He was only there for a couple of days and obviously it's winter now. So, it's a holiday with a difference. We also have some other venues on the site. Another one is another fantastic venue called Saint Armand. Saint Armand, a lot of our regulars have been, Carpcast listeners have been there already. Some of them are booked on for this year. Again, you get a farmhouse, a 170-year-old farmhouse that sleeps up to 10 people. Get your own 4.5-acre lake, which is absolutely stuffed full of fish to £50. There's lots of 40s in there, loads of 20s and 30s. And it's absolutely stunning in the Limoges area of France. It's what we want to do with VIP carp holidays. We want to focus on more family-based holidays. Again, there are about 10 weeks left on St. Armand this year. So if you do want to inquire about that, we're taking bookings for those remaining 10 weeks in 2017, or get yourself booked up for 2018. More traditional French fishing is Casse en Lac, which is also on there as well. It's a private lake hire, up to 8 people really. Decent sized lake with plenty of carp to £68. All the prices and everything, all the info you need is on vipcarpholidays.com. And you can get in touch, ask any questions, and get yourself booked up for some nice French fishing. Something else we mentioned on last week's Carpcast as well was John Max Lake in France. We are booking a trip on March the 11th, so prior to when the lake opens to the public next year. John spoke all about the lake on last week's show. If you haven't listened to that yet, then go back and have a listen. It's filling up quick. We're basically selling 8 places to go fishing with myself and John Mack. And if you want to come, Mark, then there is a week's fishing in France for you on that particular week. Price is only £350, and I think there are 4 places gone so far out of the 8. So don't hang about. If you fancy fishing with John, myself, and maybe Mark, then you need to let us know fairly quickly. If you go to the Carpcast website, www.thecarpcast.com, you can pay a deposit. You pay a 125 quid deposit, and then the rest of the balance just needs paying by sort of end of February. But I would get that deposit paid quick if you are thinking about going, because I can't see there being any places left after next week. So yeah, go and check out the Carpcast website. There's other stuff on there as well. There's you can buy the key crayon there. One of the only places you can buy it outside of the actual shows. I'm not sure how much longer we're going to be doing that offer for either, so get yourself over to the Carpcast website. There's DVDs on there. It's the cheapest place you can buy Kevin Nash's book. And www.thecarpcast.com. Anything else, Mark?
Oh, do you want a quick random review?
Yeah, go on.
True review.
I did this at work the other day. I had cold feet. I didn't notice that I've got in stock some socks from Tracker. They look quite nice, so I thought, sod it, I'm gonna buy a pair. They did actually. I've checked them before because I've got great big feet. They did stretch in there. I've got to be honest, I put them in this for a random review, a true review, because I was actually quite impressed. My feet were warm in about 5 minutes, and then after about 15 minutes and for the rest of the day, they were hot and sweaty. So it's merino wool, whatever that is. So warmth and durability. They have an interned welt. Do you know what that is? Because I haven't got a clue. But that gives you a relaxed and comfortable fit. There's ventilation channel for increased breathability as well, which is a new development in socks. As far as I know, they just look like socks to me, but what I can tell you is that they are really, really warm. I'm quite happy I got them. Keep me warm at work. Tracker Merino socks.
So I think it's about time we got Mr. Martin Clark in. Yeah, do it over the phone or on Skype or whatever. Obviously, it's a lot of money to be travelling around the country to, for an hour interview or whatever. So, yeah, it's all just done over the phone. I mean, phone, Skype, FaceTime, I can do anything, really. It always comes out fine. So the only thing is my phone, for some reason, the masts in Blackpool have not been very good for EE over the weekend, and other people have said it's been crackling a bit, so... So I'd like to welcome to the Carpcast Bedfordshire legend, Mr. Martin Clark. How are we doing, pal?
I'm okay, Jamie. I don't know about a legend, but yeah, I'm doing fine now.
Yeah, well,
it was a little bit scary, though, having a heart attack a few weeks ago.
Well, we mentioned it, and we wish you well on the last couple of podcasts, actually. I've been following following, obviously, the updates. Your daughter was posting stuff on Facebook on your account, and millions of well wishes. Give us an update. I mean, what's the state of play at the minute?
I went in for a primary angiogram. And basically they feed a couple of tubes up some of your arteries, one up my arm and then one up my groin, and then they sort of feed it all the way up into your heart, find where the blockage is, and they sort of like pump up a balloon, and then they sort of leave a sort of a cage behind, what they call a stent,
right,
which that sort of opens up the blocked heart where the blockage is. So basically I've got a stent in my heart now, which everything seems to be okay. I'm going in tomorrow, as it goes, for another test, what they call an angiogram, and that's basically a sort of similar sort of thing. They're going to feed up a tube into my heart, inject some dye, and basically sort of do a scan or an x-ray at the same time, and that will show basically the state of play of my blood vessels around my heart, so to see if there's any more or if there's any other problems, like, you know.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's actually, I can just picture what you're saying, so they, I mean...
It's frightening. I'm a little bit scared by it all, because, you know, I mean, when I first had the heart attack, and I was basically blue lighted all the way from Luton to Harefield Hospital. I can remember being on the operating table only for a few seconds, and then obviously I come to in the ward, and obviously it's all a complete shock to me. You know, I thought I was fit until that point. You know, I never had any breathing problems or, you know, I've never encountered any problems with my heart at all.
Just completely out of the blue?
Completely out of the blue, yeah. I did pull a muscle in my shoulder the week before, on the Wednesday, and then I went to work on a Thursday and Friday, everything seemed okay, and then that weekend my shoulder was still playing up, and I thought, well, sod that, I'm not going to go to work. You know, I'm not super desperate for the money. I thought, I'll have a few days off, and hopefully my shoulder will get better. Just so happens that weekend, me and my brother scattered my mum and dad's ashes. So I don't know if it was sort of stress related or had anything to do with my shoulder injury. But anyway, sort of Wednesday, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was at home. All of a sudden, the pain, I just can't describe it. It felt like someone parked a transit van on each shoulder.
Wow.
And it just went straight across my chest, and I was breathing sort of like 100 miles an hour. Shouted to my daughter, who's in the next room. I said, ring 999, I think I'm having a heart attack. She rang 999. I asked her a few questions, and then I said to her, well, it doesn't sound life-threatening, ring 111. A bit laughable, really, but she didn't. Well, thankfully, she didn't ring 111. She rang my wife at work. She said, "Well, I'm on my way home now. Ring 99 again." So she rang 999 again, and again, run through a couple of questions. I mean, obviously, a couple of minutes, probably a minute or so, had passed. And I just basically collapsed on the floor, you know, rolled on my back on the floor. You know, I was on the verge of passing out. And then all I can remember is that a paramedic turned up probably within 5 minutes, put an ECG monitor on me, and phoned an ambulance straight away. And then about 10 minutes later, the bedroom's full up with paramedics and, you know, the ambulance crew, and they carried me downstairs. Mrs. jumped in the front seat of the ambulance, and off we went to Harefield. Within a couple of minutes, I'm feeling sick, so I'm puking up in a carrier bag. You know, they threw a carrier bag in front of me, and I'm puked up. And obviously, I think they give me a couple of milligrams of morphine or some other drugs, and I couldn't really remember much about the hospital journey up the motorway. And like I say, the next thing I can remember is on the operating theatre, and then I seem to sort of I was blacked out, or they put me out, I don't know. When they'd done the procedure, and like I say, a couple of hours later, I think I woke up on the hospital ward. Wife was there, told me what happened, and that was that. I think I was in the hospital for a week, and I probably the first two or three days I was basically sick every it felt like I was being sick every sort of 3 or 4 hours, and I was sort of puking up a sort of browny liquid. It looked like brown soup, like Oxtail soup or something. I wasn't eating anything. I was just, I think it was like blood that sort of seeped in through the walls of my stomach, because they thin your blood down really, really thin, so it, so it flows through your system pretty quick and that. And then for the rest of the week, it sort of gradually got better. Instead of puking up brown liquid, I was sort of like reaching to try to puke. But all I was coming up with was about half an egg cup full of phlegm and a bit of red blood, And by the end of the week, I was proper glad to get out of there, because I felt hungry, but I felt sick. But every time I tried to eat something, all I ate each day was probably 3 spoonfuls of cornflakes, a couple of bites of a bit of toast, and a cup of tea. So,
weird, isn't it? If you don't associate the sickness with like a heart attack or something, do they know what that is?
Well, I don't know whether it was the shock of it all. Trying to go to sleep was an absolute nightmare. I was all sort of having, it felt like I was having a panic attack every minute or every 2 minutes, because I'd sort of like be breathing normally, for sort of a couple of minutes, and all of a sudden I'll start breathing really quickly again, like it was a panic attack sort of thing, The only good thing I can say about my hospital, my time in the week in hospital, was I was in a sort of like a 6-bed ward, and there was like a couple of blokes opposite me, older blokes, and it was a bit like Harry Enfield, those like Harry Enfield characters, and they was they was having a bit of banter with the nurses and having a bit of banter with the other patients. By the end of the week, I started getting involved with the conversation, so to speak, and that was about the only good thing I can say about the hospital visit. And but since coming home, I've had literally a letter every day, and I've got to go back for scans. I've got to go on a treadmill. Where you sort of test your oxygen and blood, I don't know, loads of tests. So it's going to be interesting. Obviously I'm not going to go to work, sod the brick lane, so hopefully in the next couple of months I'll be able to do a bit of fishing in between the hospital sessions,
How do you actually feel, strength-wise? Do you feel delicate or...
I feel fine. Like I say, the first couple of days coming home, I was still weak, obviously I started eating a few things at home. Oddly enough, things that I thought I'd sort of binge on, I didn't like the taste of. Chocolate, tasted horrible. Before that, I used to love a bit of chocolate, Maltesers, anything with chocolate on it, and I'd eat it. But I tried some M&M's, like chocolate coated peanuts, had a couple of them, and I just tasted bloody horrible,
It's weird, isn't it, how it affects you, like obviously it's one organ, but it affects so many things, and like affecting your taste buds and all sorts.
I think your taste buds are coming back to normal now, So it's taken a couple of weeks for it to sort of everything to sort of settle down. My heart feels fine. I mean, the first couple of days I went, you know, went out for a walk up the shops, got like slightly uphill, and I had to stop a couple of times, you know, every 100 yards for a bloody breather. I felt like I've been running like 500-600 yards, you know.
Yeah.
The last 3 or 4 days I've been going out for a walk in the evenings, doing about a mile and a half, and my breathing's exactly the same when I get home as when I leave home, so to speak, you know, so everything feels fine. I mean, probably if I started running, I haven't tried running yet, but I think if I started running, it might... I'll be breathing like a bloody, puffing like a big, you know, old train, like, you know what I mean? So I'm just taking things easy day by day, really, and I think I'll be okay fishing. I mean, I've got a couple of places where I can literally fish out the back of my car or out the back of my van, so I haven't got to carry my tackle any distance. All I've got to hope for is that there's a few carp showing in the swims that are, you know, where you can fish out the back of your van, you know.
Electric barra, next on the Christmas list.
I have developed a barra bed. I don't know if you've seen any pictures. It's probably on my Facebook page somewhere.
Yeah.
And that's my next development. I will be developing an electric barra bed.
Ah.
So all in the pipeline, it's, you know, but...
So moving on to the fishing, obviously we wish you well. Mark Watts, a new co-host with me as well, he asked me to send you wishes when I told him I was about to speak to you, as I'm sure all our listeners do. As I say, we have mentioned it a couple of times. So, I mean, that's the worst nightmare. Obviously, fishing's a way of life, a passion, you know, an obsession for most of us. And as long as you can still do that, you know, there's ways to earn money and get creative, as long as you can still get out there. I mean, that's the biggest nightmare, isn't it, being sort of incapacitated. So it sounds like you're still going to be able to pursue the carping. Let's go back to where it started then. Like, I mean, how old were you when you first realised you had that, you know, you wanted to go fishing more than anything else, or chase women, or whatever you're doing at that age?
Yeah, hard to say, really. I suppose it's probably when I was about 20, 21. Before I sort of really got into carp fishing, I used to like tench fishing. I used to like fishing for rudd and roach and all different species, really. Yeah. And I had a couple of sessions on string reservoirs, and a bit embarrassing, really, because I used to work... sort of bit part-time down Leslie's of Luton, and a few of us used to go over Tring Reservoirs tench fishing, you know, just to a night, really. I mean, the fishing during the daytime was pretty tense, but as soon as it got dark, the tench switched on, big stop light, you know, and I pretty much sussed out how to catch them, and lots of them pretty quick, you know, like I say, used to struggle in the daytime, but as soon as it got night, I mean, the killer method was float fishing in the margins with like little LED floats, and fishing chop log worms, like, you know, so you used to sort of like chop, you know, cut a log worm into three with a pair of scissors, whack on a sort of like inch and a half section of worm on a size 10 hook and fish it sort of lay it up, you know, sort of a foot on the bottom, so to speak, and as soon as it, well, anyway, cut a long story short, I can remember probably my last session on there, as it goes. I turned up about an hour before it got dark, managed to get in my favourite swim, which is in one corner of the Marsworth Reservoir, and as I'm sort of setting my float rod up, a bloke's turned up next to me, literally the very next swim, about 10 yards away, on the other side of a tree, and he stuck a bivvy up. I was like, oh, yeah, looks like he's keen, and next thing, he's got a marker rod, and left plumber about, I don't know, 30, 40 yards out. Next thing, he's come out with a spod rod, and he starts spodding up. I thought, oh yeah, what's going on here, like, you know? And there's me, I'm just sitting there with a float rod. I hadn't even bothered casting in. I've just, it's all ready to go, really. I'm just waiting for it to get dark, you know? Put a couple of balls of ground bait in, some few chopped worms and that. Next thing, he starts spodding out. Well, he's got a bucket, and he's got every bait imaginable, really. You know, maggots, squats, and pinkies, and casters, and bread flake, and, you know, anyway, he's spodding out, and he's had about 30 casts. Next thing, he's cast a feeder each side of the float. And I'm thinking, oh, this could be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I'll flip my float out. Chucked out literally like two or three bits of chopped worm. And I cut a long story short, it was embarrassing, really. I mean, in the end, he's stopped fishing. Well, he's left his rods out, and he's basically behind me, and he's chatting away, and he's obviously watching my float. And I'm literally catching a tench or a bream or a big roach probably every 5 minutes, on average, I suppose. Anyway, he gets a bleep and runs back to his swim and strikes, and his next thing, he's got a bream, I don't know, 7 pounds, so out comes his keep net. He's popped the bream in the keep net. Anyway, he's cast back out, and 10 minutes later, he's back chatting to me, and I'm just catching every 5 minutes, like, you know. And it just so happens I had probably the biggest net you could buy at the time. You know, it was, you know, 12 foot long, and, well, you could have got three or four blokes in it and stood them up, you know what I mean? You know, it was that big. Anyway, cut it, another hour goes, and next thing, his buzzer bleeps again, so he's back in his swim, and he caught a tench. So, okay, he's had one tench and one bream. Well, I'd lost count by that stage. Anyway, he's been with me another hour, and I think obviously he's got bored or pissed off watching me, you know, and he's gone in with his bivvy, and that was the last I saw of him, so to speak. You know, anyway, in the morning, you weren't allowed to fish on Sundays, so you had to sort of like pack up sort of like 8 o'clock in the morning and go home, you know. So anyway, I've packed my body away and told me what's the way in it, and he wandered round, you know, he's had his fry up, and he's wandered round to me, and he said, I says, oh, did you have any more through the night? He says, no, that was it, just two bites, one bream, one tench. He says, what about yourself, did you carry on catching? I says, yeah, I says, pretty much all the way through the night, like, you know. I says, I'm going to pull my net out now, do you want to give us a hand? Yeah, all right. And anyway, so we both sort of like started pulling my net in. Well, we just, two of us, we couldn't lift it out. We just could not lift it out of the water. And I said, no, it's just, this ain't going to work, mate. I said, let's just let them swim out, like, you know. So he's lifted one end up and just let them swim out. But I would imagine I had 300-400 pound plus of, like, tension bream. I didn't bother putting the roach in. I just put, like, the decent bream in them, and mostly tench. I honestly lost count. And that was the last time I thought, do you know what? This is ridiculous. You know, it's sort of, I don't know, it seemed criminal to ram so many fish. Although I had the biggest net you could get hold of, it just seemed wrong to cram fish into a keep net. And that was the last time I went tench fishing. And
just put you off it, just like that.
Well, I mean, I've done a little bit of carp fishing on the canals. I mean, nothing big, you know. Lucky if you caught a 10-pounder. Most of them are sort of like 6 to 8 pound, that sort of size. You know, Grand Union Canal round the Tring Reservoirs was absolutely rammed with carp.
Yeah.
And it was pretty, it was easy fishing, you know. You just used a bit of sweet corn or a bit of bread, and you couldn't go wrong, really. The Tring Canal was full of them then. This is back in, what, I don't know, the late 70s, you know, and anyway, sort of 1970s, 79, I suppose, 1980, I thought, right, I want to catch a 20-pound carp, you know. I knew a few places that had them, and it was just a question of, like, going there and trying to catch them, you know. As luck would have it, I suppose the first year that I did sort of decide that I was going to be a carp angler, I didn't really know what carp angler was. All I knew is that it was a sort of a specimen group that wasn't really interested in catching other fish other than carp, you know. So my first 20 pounder was, I think, 1980 from Wogan Sands in Bedfordshire, like a little 5-acre club pit run by Vauxhall Angling Club, and I managed to catch the first year I had half a dozen doubles out of there, and one 20 pounder. I caught that stalking with one rod, so that was
I know the lake well. I was there a few years after you, I think, fishing in a swim known as Clarkies, which is like the one kind of between the gap between that little back bit.
Yeah.
And there, fish called Scaly, wasn't there? Was the big one in there?
Did you catch Scaly?
Yeah, I did. I think I was either the first or second person to have it at 30, which was probably a few years after you were on there. I think it was 31-1 or something.
Yeah, that was a real nice sort of classic Scaly. I mean, it was reputed to some fish come from Redmere. Well, I don't know how true it was. You know, I won't name names, but a couple of famous people that used to fish or had connections to people that used to fish Redmere. I don't know whether it was the same with the Olsey carp. You know, I don't know where they originated from, but again, rumours have it that a few baby carp were moved around in the early 60s and 70s, and I should imagine that's how Vauxhall managed to get stocked with carp.
They were old fish, weren't they? So
they're very old fish. Yeah, I mean, you probably do know the person I'm talking about. He's in his 70s now. Yeah. I won't name names.
I'm aware.
Yeah. I mean, he was responsible for stocking a few Bedfordshire lakes. Again, it was basically putting little babies in, you know.
Yeah.
You know, like just a few ounces, really. And, you know, blow me down, you're 5 years down the line, 10 pounders and people start fishing for them, you know.
I
have no idea how old Scaly was, but it did go up to about, I don't know if it was 38 or 37 something. When I fished it, I had it I think it went until about the third year I was fishing there that I actually caught. I did lose it once, and then I managed to catch it 3 years on the trot, all in December. Never did catch it in the summer. Wow. It was all in December. 27.5, I think, was the biggest I had
it. It was pretty deep, wasn't it, that pit? That's maybe why it fished late.
Yeah. I mean, most of my fishing was in the margins.
Yeah.
I mean, I did have quite a few out on the surface, summer and winter. But most of my fishing was in the margins. Fishing in that swim called Clark is literally fishing a rod length out, and we've got, you know, no bobbins, ultra slack line.
Yeah.
Semi-six rigs. I mean, my favourite rig at the time there was 3 bits of nylon, 2.7 bayer perlon. So, like an invisible rig, really, you know.
What did they call that back in the day? I remember that. So like 3 light bits of nylon all in like a multi-strand almost, isn't it?
Yeah. I was first shown that rig by a chap over on an Oxford lake called Stanton and Harcourt.
You're
probably aware of that.
Yeah, another Vauxhall water.
Yeah, run by Vauxhall as well. I mean, it did have some big carp in there back in the early 80s. I mean, I never know for sure, but I personally definitely had carp up to 40 pound. and that was the early 80s. Used to see them. Catching them was another thing altogether, though, you know.
Yeah, it was a tricky one there. I went down there a few times and never caught a fish. A lot of tench there was. And then I believe they had a fish kill, didn't they, years later?
Yeah. I mean, it has been, I think, a few horseshoe carp have made their way into there now. I think Corder have got it now. I think Vauxhall sold it. So,
really?
I think it's one of the embryo waters now. I'm not totally sure. I'll have to do a bit of digging, but lovely gravel pit. I mean, that was my... Well, probably one of the first gravel pits I ever fished. And again, I fished that when I was a boy in probably 1974. Vauxhall used to do a little coach trip. No. So I used to get on the coach in Luton, you know, throw your tackle on, underneath the coach, be 20, 30 anglers all drive there. Of course, the old boys, they knew the score. They'd put their tackle on under the coach last, so when you get off at the other end, they'd be the first one out with their tackle. So it was a bit of a joke, really, me and my mates, because we was a bit naive. We'd get our tackle out, and then there'd be no swims left. So we're going, oh, bloody hell, this is bloody good, isn't it? You know, so we used to poach on the lake on the other side of the road, which the police used to run.
Right.
I think Peter Drennan owns that lake now. But yeah, we used to fish on that lake, and there also used to be another lake right behind Stanton Harcourt that's been filled in now, and that was a lovely little gravel pit. No idea who owned it or who run it, but like I say, if we couldn't get a swim on Stanton Harcourt, we used to go and poach some of the others, like, you know. No one used to say a thing back in the 70s, like, you know.
Well, there's a lot of water around there.
Look out. Stanton used to be full of chub back then. Full of chub. Yeah. I mean, a really easy lake to catch chub out of.
Wow.
All you needed was a bubble float, about 3 or 4 foot hook link, cut the casters, and, you used to see the chub boiling on the surface, so if you managed to get you could chase them around the lake, really, sort of just put a few pouchfuls of casters out, and you know what chub like, they're really greedy, and cast your bubble float out. Within 2 minutes, you get a bite.
Yeah.
And slow sinking casters.
And being from Bedfordshire, I mean, you didn't really have to travel to Oxford to find some really big carp. There was a lake probably shrouded in secrecy in the very early days, but that was Elstow, wasn't it? That was somewhere that you became synonymous with.
Yeah, I mean, first time I ever walked around Elstow was 1976, and there was a council refuse tip at one end of it, and they was basically just filling it with rubbish. You know, back in those days, it was like an open tip, so the old dust carts used to pull up, offload, and there'd be a lot of bulldozer just sort of like bulldozing it in, you know, whatever, and it stunk to high heaven. I mean, when the wind was blowing towards you, the stench coming off of that tip, it was enough to put most people, it put me off, you know. I mean, I used to fish, the end of the 70s and 80s, I used to fish Brockborough and Stewartby, which is sort of like just up the road, really.
Yeah.
I don't think big lakes are any harder than small lakes, you know. If anything, I'd say they're easier fishing. It's all about location. If you can locate the fish, you know, you will catch them. It weren't until probably when I did start carp fishing, I did know there was carp in Elstow, but I used to like fishing open sands, and that sort of, I don't know, the time that I had back then, you know, it suited me down the ground. You know, I did fish a few other places as well. I think when it comes to sort of like looking at catching something bigger than £27, I moved on to Harefield, which is down in the Colne Valley. That was probably 1987, I started fishing Harefield.
Ah, so you fished there before
Elstow. I was aware that Elstow did have a few cut 30 pounders in there.
Mm.
But, you know, like I say, once Harefield got under my skin, I think I was a member of Harefield for about 6 or 7 years. And then obviously you become aware of a few other Colne Valley waters and a few other waters in the Berkshire area. And it wasn't until 1996, I think, that I actually fished Elstow for carp.
So it
but,
was...
Yeah, once I realised how many big carp there was in Elstow, that was it. I wanted a ticket, and luckily I got a ticket. And I think I was a member there. Well, I was a bailiff on there for a few years. But all in all, I probably fished there, Elstow, for, I think, 16 years. I've still got a ticket, actually. But I've dropped out of pit one. I've sort of kept my ticket on pit two.
Who was on Harefield back in then? If you were there before Elstow, then there must have been that must have been in the heyday of Harefield, I guess.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, well, back in '87, most of the Colne Valley lakes that had any, you know, had decent fishing were sort of like pretty hard to get into.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were a few. I mean, the Waltonians and the Cons, you had to sort of like know someone. It was like a vetting procedure to get in there. Whereas Harefield, it was run by William Boyers. It's basically pay your money and you're in.
Yeah.
You know, there was supposedly a limit on the numbers of anglers, but it was a bit of a joke, really. I think the last couple of years that I had a Harefield ticket, I think there was about 100 members.
Right.
Which is quite a lot, really. You know, it's about 50 acres, but 100 members on a 50-acre lake is a little bit too many, in my opinion. You know, every time you went there was always sort of 10 people already fishing.
Yeah.
And when it was back in the days when there was a close season, you used to do a draw for your swims sort of 2 or 3 weeks before the start of the season. I mean, come June the 16th, every swim was taken that first week. Mm. Every single swim. And there was probably about 40, 50 swims on there, like, you know. But it did have a few 30s in there. I mean, I think the late, when I joined it, the late record was 39. But I think that fish died, I think, the first year I joined it, 87. But there was a few, well, I think there was half a dozen 30s in there.
Mm. That was a lot for that time.
Over the course of my membership, you know, after 6 years, there was over 20 30s in there. So they was growing.
Yeah.
And as luck would have it, I had the three biggest. I doubled up on the three biggest carp in there, so I done well. I learned basically a lot on Harefield, a lot about bait and a lot about location. You know, summer and winter, and obviously fishing amongst the who's who of carp fishing back in those days. You know, you had your Rob Maylin and his mates on there, and Bernard Loftus and Sandy Shaw. I can't remember, what was Sandy's name? But,
yeah.
You know, Bernard Loftus, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah, no, Bernie, and
yeah, I mean,
Sandy from back in the day, yeah.
He caught a lot of carp out there on the L2s. So he was like, looking and learning off of everyone, really. I think everyone learned something from each other. And obviously you had your, sort of your Colne Valley regulars down there. I mean, to be honest, they were shown up by the people that travelled from, you know, further afield, really. So just because it was on their sort of local home turf, so to speak, they didn't really show us Luton boys how to do it, you know. I mean, if anything, we show them how to do it, you know.
I've come across that one many times, being a travelling angler. I mean, I'm from Bedfordshire, as you may or may not know, but, you know, yeah. I moved up north for work. I can't remember how long ago, but, yeah, so, you know, I was a keen angler in them days. I mean, I almost caught the end of your sort of Harefield regime. I was I got a Boyle Leisure ticket to join Harefield. They put me on a waiting list for that year, and I ended up buying the coverall permit or whatever, and got to really like Rodney Meadow. I started fishing there, and I think Rodney Meadow opened a month before. I think it opened the 1st of June, whereas Harefield opened the 16th or something. So might have even opened the 1st of May, actually. But anyway, I remember I'd been stuck in for a few weeks on Rodney Meadow and really liked it. And then I got a letter in the post saying you can have a Harefield ticket if you want. Now, I'd only caught 130 then, which was scaly. And I was like, and Rodney Meadow had 230s in, I think. And I think at the time, was it called Small Pecks, the biggest in... or Little Pecks or something, the biggest in Harefield. It was a scraper 40. Peck, I think there was a big common as well, wasn't there, at the time? I can't remember.
Well, there was a big common, but no one caught it. I'll swear blind there was one in there, sort of. Well, the biggest common that got caught when I was there, was, 35 pounds. But I'll swear blind I'll see one in there, and I'll swear blind I hooked it. And I know for a fact a few other anglers hooked a big common that could well have been £40, but no one landed anything bigger than £35.
It's
one of them places, you know, it had a little bit of mystery, and there was another big mirror that well, whether it was spawn bound or not, but there was a big mirror that looked 40. I remember seeing one, I'm thinking, bloody hell, that's looking big. But no one ever, you know, it was just like the known fish that used to get caught all the time, you know, like the known fish, the fully scaled, small pecks, Nelson, you know, them sort of fish.
Did it up your game as far as sort of techniques? There was a lot of long range fishing and bars, and you know, you had to pay attention to what you're doing, didn't you, for cut offs and for getting out amongst the bars and stuff. So I mean, did it sort of move you forward tackle wise and just general ability?
One thing I did learn a lot about was something that people seem to have forgotten about these days is fishing single hook baits. I mean, in the winter over Harefield, like a lot of lakes really, I suppose, you get a load of tufties and coots, and so, you know, people that put bait out with a throwing stick, not only would the seagulls get half of it, or most of it, wake up in the morning, the bloody tufties would be diving on. So, in the end, I did do a couple of winter sessions on there, and I sort of did try and put bait out, but in the open, you know, the main open part of the lake, which is where they sort of tend to hold up in the winter, putting bait out was just a nightmare, you know. So in the end I thought, you know what, I'm just going to fish single hook baits. Obviously, fishing single hook baits, you can't just sort of turn up, whack out anywhere. You've got to find the fish. So, I think the first session I done over there, I think it took me. Put it this way, I just walked around with my hands in my pockets for probably about 3 hours before I actually see a fish show itself. You know, and I thought, right, well, now I've seen one. So you sit down. Get your flask out, have a cup of tea and a smoke, and see if you can see any more. And you know, that first sort of session that I'd done there in the winter, I saw probably 3 or 4. I thought, well, that's something to go on. The following weekend I went back, no one fishing there. This would be like December, probably first week in December, and I've got my rods together, singular baits, and I basically, you know, knew what swim I wanted to be in, and I knew the distance, you know, the marker on the far bank I needed to cast at. So I've like launched out two at baits. As far as I, as luck would have it, it was probably on the extremities of how far I could cast at the time, you know, probably about 140, 150 yards. And I whacked out two baits. And I'm not one for casting them out and like leaving them sitting on the bottom where they land. I want to pull back just to know what I'm fishing on. But I don't want to pull back a couple of yards. I just want to pull the lead a foot. That's all I want to move it, you know what I mean? Anyway, so I've whacked out a couple of baits, and on both rods, I'm sort of like tightened the line up, and I'm pulling, just gently, gently pulling, and I put the rod against my forehead, so I can sort of like just sort of pull gently, you know what I mean? And all of a sudden, I felt my lead sort of like pull out the silt, and it was probably the thickest silt in there. It felt like I'd cast into sort of like a big vat of butter, you know? And all of a sudden, I felt the lead. As soon as I felt the lead move, that was it. I sort of slackened off the line. Thought, right, that's it. All I've done is just basically unplugged the lead from the silt, and it's obviously resting on top of the silt, you know, fishing pop-ups. Slowly tighten up, put the rod on the rest, heavy bobbing on. Blow me down, an hour later, scream and run. Well, cut a long story short, I think the first session I had I had two runs the first day and two runs the second. I just did one night, you know, two runs the second day. And I lost, and everything I saw jump or poke its head out was big, really big. And the only fish I landed was small pecs at 39.5.
On your first session in December.
Yeah, all the big fish were there, showing themselves, like, you know. I thought, blimey, this is all right. So, went back the following week. And I took a lie, 3 days later, I'm back again. I thought, sod this, I need to be over Airfield. You know, obviously, confident in my rig, and confident in my bait, and confident where I need to cast, and, you know, obviously I knew I could hit it. Done sort of 2 days, one night session sort of thing. And anyway, I had five runs and I only landed two. So look, now I was losing more than what I was actually landing, you know. I think I had I can't remember the second session, I think I had a 30 and a 29, I think. I might have had a cut of 30s, I'm not sure. And again, everything I see show is big, you know. So Another week later, I'm back again. Same thing again. Done a, you know, like 2 days, one night. I think I had four runs that time, and I think I landed two. Anyway, when I was playing one of the fish, I'm thinking, "Plum, this feels a bit weird," you know. Anyway, slowly but surely, I'm playing it. You know, I'm fishing over, you know, gone over three bars. So you got to play it literally with your rod high up. You know, like your arms fully stretched. You got the rod butt in your shoulder, sort of thing. You know. All of a sudden, I see this lump of wood come out of the water. I thought, what the bloody hell's that? So I'm gently playing it in, and it looked like a lump of 4x2. About 5-6 foot long, like, you know, like a fence post attached to me line. I'm thinking, oh my god, like, you know, what the bloody hell's that? So then slowly but surely played it in. Luckily the bit of wood fell off, and it was literally like a bit of 4x2. Oh, sorry, 4x4, you know, like a proper fence post sort of thing, yeah. Like, you know. And anyway, I landed that fish, and it was a 30, and before I had a recast, I checked my line, and how I landed that fish, I'll never know, because it had literally gone through cut through 3/4 of my line. So out, you know, I was probably playing the fish on about 2 pounds line, if you know what I mean, when I actually landed it. But after that, the bite seemed to slow up, but I landed virtually every fish. So that obviously that snag that was out there was a possible, I don't know, could have been one of these rubbing posts. You know, I mean, carp have a tendency to find a snag and use that to roll on and rub against.
Yeah.
So it may well have been a post that had been out there for Christ knows how long. And I was obviously using that as a something to roll or rub against, you know. And yeah. But yeah, I've still got a few bites, and I think I ended up with 11 carp that winter. I fish in it sort of like once a week for a sort of 6 week period type of thing, you know.
Mm.
And I even had, well, I think it froze on me, I don't know, I think it is the end of January, I think it was. I had one the day before it froze, and obviously done the night, didn't know what the forecast was because there weren't no mobile phones back in those days, you know.
Mm.
And woke up in the morning, the lake was frozen on me. I thought, oh, bloody hell, this is looking a bit grim, you know.
Mm.
So I'm sitting there thinking, oh, I hope I don't get a run. And of course, at sort of 8:30, 9 o'clock, that was like the early morning sort of bite time. Sure enough, I got a bloody bite, you know. So I'm playing a fish through the ice. Yeah, I knew I was going to lose it. And obviously, I did lose it. And that was it. It froze solid for about 6 weeks. So that was me winter over, really. I went back the last weekend of the season. I don't know how I managed to get in the same swim. I don't know, but luck would have it, I got in the same swim, and I had the only fish of that weekend. You know, it was about 20 other anglers on that last weekend. It's weird, but you always used to sort of switch on. You know, you'd see a lot more fish rolling, showing themselves. You know, that last, well, which would be March the 15th, you know, that sort of around that time, sort of second week in March, that's when they sort of started to become a bit more active. Obviously, that's the last weekend, so everyone's got one little chance of looking something before the season closes, and, you know, I managed to have a 28-pounder, and then that was the last year I fished it.
Do you think winters were a bit easier back then? Do you think they've got tougher over the years, maybe more bait going in throughout the year or whatever? Have you noticed a difference, or is it much the same?
I don't know. It's a bit hard to say. I mean, you know, since those days on Harefield, you know, and obviously since Facebook, I mean, obviously you've got thousands of friends, and I've got thousands of friends, and I'll get a fair bit of correspondence with people that I know and people that I don't really know, you know, and a lot of private messages, and I have a few phone conversations with a few people, and I honestly think that a lot of lakes, people are putting too much bait in.
Yeah.
And it's all very well one person doing it, you know, but when you get half a dozen people doing it, it can kill it. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, carp ain't stupid, and I mean, somewhere like Elstow, I mean, that's, I don't know, Elstow doesn't seem as bad as some other lakes, but I think that's down to the fact that a lot of the blokes that do fish Elstow have fished Elstow for a number of years, and they know where they need to be, and they know how much bait they can get away with using and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
So they tend, I mean, what Elstow fish is good in the winter. It has the odd winter where it fishes a bit slow, but I think a lot of it now, I mean, some other lakes that my mates are fishing, you know, like on the Rogue Lake on Staines, and couple of Colne Valley lakes as well, because they're using spons and spods.
Mm.
They're putting in more bait, you know. Back in the 80s, 90s, there was no spons, so people, you know, that did use boilies used a throwing stick, and as a consequence, you know, they only sort of put out maybe a pound of bait when it got dark.
Yeah.
You know, obviously you try and do it during the daytime and that's it, the seagulls are on your case. But now with spawns, people can get away with putting out kilos of bait. You know, I know some lakes where everyone puts out 5 kilos of bait. And you think, blimey, if everyone's doing it, so a lot of bait going in, you know. Mm. And as a consequence, not a lot's getting caught, you know. And people don't realise, carp don't need to, they don't really need to eat a lot of bait. You know, they're quite happy with 10, 20 bloody boilies, you know. And
that,
you've got to do your sums.
That was it.
A couple of kilos, that's a couple of thousand boilies, isn't it, you know?
That was it back in the day. We used to put our rods out and catapult 20 boilies around it, you know, a bag of Richwas, which was probably a kilo, you know, in the 80s. Yeah. But that'd last me weeks, you know. It took me a week's paper round to pay for it. But, you know, I'd make that last. It'd certainly last all week, you know, fishing five
nights.
I do
feel that if someone's struggling, on any, it doesn't matter where they're fishing, whether it's a little lake or a big lake, if they're putting in bait, you know, like more than a couple of kilos, and they're not getting the bites, well, simple in my it's simple, just don't put any bait in.
Mm.
You know, you just say to yourself, sod it, next weekend I'm just going to fish with either singlet baits or 25 baits, you know, and just see what happens, you know. And it's like, I mean, when I was catching, go back to the days, you know, of Airfield in the winter when I was catching on singlet baits, I didn't know I was going to catch on singlet baits. I just thought, oh, sod it, I need to get a bait out there where they're showing, and if I get a bite, I'll get a bite. If I don't, I don't. It's one of them things, and obviously you get a few bites and your confidence, once you've built that confidence up, and you, that's it, you know what you need to do. It might, you know, some, I mean, for instance, Woven Sands, I used to put every fish I caught, I used to put out about, I don't know, 30, 40 boilies, 14 mil boilies, and about 3 handfuls of hemp.
Mm.
You know, every single fish, and I used to catch 4 or 5 fish every weekend.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I caught, you know, I mean, I can remember a few sessions where I had like 3 or 4 in one night. You know, every couple of hours, I'd catch a fish.
Hmm.
So I'd catch during the daytime, but at night, blimey, that place used to switch on, you know. But I think if I'd have gone in straight away and gone, right, well, here, I have 2 kilos of bait and have a bucket of hemp, I probably would have only caught 1 or 2 fish.
Over a whole
weekend, you know. I think I might have gone over the top, you know.
So if you know you're going to fish a single hook bait, would you do anything different, or just use the bait that you're going to use anyway, or would you go for something more attract based, or have you got a favourite single hook bait?
My opinions with single hook baits may differ to some people. Now, obviously, if you're only fishing a single hook bait, it's not like they're going to eat it. Okay, so that's my opinion. They're not physically going to eat that bait because it's attached to your hair.
Yeah.
Right. Now, but back in, I mean, well, me and my mates, we used to fish a place called Stanbury Lakes in Welling Garden City. Now, it was one of them weird council lakes where they didn't want you firing out boilies. I don't know why, but anyway.
Yeah, I fished it, I know all about it.
We used to fish either single hook baits or stringers.
Mm.
Okay. Now, obviously, it was to make, well, how can I say it? Whether we're right or whether we're wrong, you know, if you cast out a stringer, you've got the attraction of 4 or 5 baits plus your up bait, and obviously we used to get a few bites, and so we used to think, right, well, obviously 4 or 5, you know, they're attracted by 4 or 5 baits, so we tried, we went and going, okay, well, let's make our up baits with 5 times the recommended dosage, you know, And I think back in the early days when I sort of started making my own bait, in the 80s, I was using, say, like Scopex. Now, I used to use 5mm in a 6-egg mix.
Mm.
We used to use 5 or 6 mil in a 1-egg mix.
Yeah.
So technically, the bait was sort of like 4, 5, even 6 times the recommended level, you know. Mm. Well, not only that, once we made our little 1-egg mix, we used to put another 5 mil, you know, used to make up like a little batch of 50 pop-ups, and we'd stick another 5 mil in the pot and shake it around. So they had even more, you know. You'd throw them in that pot, I think, blimey. You know, you used to pop one in your mouth and you'd go, oh, fucking hell, it tastes bloody horrible. Well over the top, well over the top. But I think the nitty gritty is whether or not a carp picks it up, you know. And when you use them and a carp picks it up, you think, well, obviously, they're attracted by that high level of flavour. It's not putting them off. If it put them off, they wouldn't pick it up. You know, and that was, I mean, I've done it on airfield, Taplow, and a few other places. I shouldn't really mention Taplow, but a few other places, just fishing a singlet bait that's literally got 5 times the level what you would normally use, you know, if you was going to put out any freebies.
So my
opinion is high track baits definitely do work, especially in the winter. I mean, they do work in the summer. I think it'll work better in the winter, you know.
That's backed up by somebody else who we've had on the show a few times who likes his single up baits. That's Frank Warwick. He's talked about using Midick. He says exactly what you've just said. He goes really high on the flavourings in these single hook baits, like stupidly high, even higher than what you're talking in some of them.
Well, I'll tell you a little story. This is a funny one.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, I used to use a company called Cotswold Baits.
Yeah.
And I had a flavour called What's It. And it smells absolutely beautiful. It's sort of like a, it's one of them smells, you smell it and you go, what's it? What's that? You know what I mean? So, so they picked the right name for it, but it was sort of like a cherry flavour.
Yeah.
Like a sweet cherry flavour. And believe it or not, it was rubbish in the summer. You know, we'd tried baits, you know, normal, stick to what they recommended, you know, their flavour levels and whatever. And you struggle catching, you think. But in the winter, it really come into its own. And it was one of them baits that the colder it was, the better it would work. And, you know, back in those days, I used to use a milk protein base mix. And to make our pop-ups for the winter, you'd literally make a 1-egg mix, you know, 5 mil of, just for example, 5 mil of, you know, 1-egg mix, yeah. And you'd boil them, say, do sort of like 10 at a time, you know, 10 baits in a boiling pan of water for about a minute and a half, scoop them out with a sieve, straight away used to mount them on a cocktail stick. So they'd be quite hot when you're handling them, so you'd ram a cocktail stick in, so the cocktail stick would just poke out the other end by, you know, like a couple of millimetres. And you'd let them dry out on a towel, so you'd have a 1-egg mix, each one would be stuck on a cocktail stick. Once it all dried out, give them an hour to fully sort of like dry out, and then you used to put them in a microwave on a plate, again, sort of about 10, 15, 20 baits, maybe. No more than 20 baits. Mm-hmm. It's probably normally about 15 baits on a plate. Put them in the microwave. I think it was probably about, I don't know, 2 minutes in the microwave for each batch of 15 baits. So the old microwave will ping. So you pull the plate out straight away. And obviously the pop-ups, so they did sort of expand a little bit. Not only a couple of millimetres, you know. And used to pull the cocktail sticks out and then put them in an ice cream, a sort of an old ice cream. small ice cream tub. Chuck them in the ice cream tub with about 5 or 10 mil of your glug or your attractant.
Mm.
So that was soaking up straight away. So you needed the whole batch. You know, just to say you've got 50, 60 pop-ups. So you'd have an ice cream tub with, yeah, you might start off with, say, like 10 mil of flavour in it. And it would, within a few minutes, those 50, 60 baits would absorb that, your glug, you know, your entire 10 mil of glug.
Hmm.
So just put another 10 mil of glug in, give them a shake around. An hour later, you'd open the tub up, and they'd be dry. So you put another 10 mil of your glug in, and give it a shake around, you know. So sometimes you used to do that maybe 5 times. So you could literally be fishing, you know, putting in like 50 mil of flavour, or what I used to call, your glug, into that one egg mix. So what, and then basically just put them in the pot, and use them as and when you use them, you know. And so they'd be really, I don't know, I never did get a calculator out to work out how much over the top they were.
Yeah.
I can remember using this flavour called What's It. And obviously when I was fishing airfield, to hit the range, you know, the smaller your hook bait,
yeah,
you know, the easier it is to cast 150 yards. You know, I mean, as an example, you could probably hit 150 yards using a 14 mil pop-up.
Mm.
Some of the pop-ups were like 18 mil, and you'd struggle to get the distance.
Yeah.
So, as a consequence, I'd sort of purposely pick out all the smaller ones, and the bigger ones I'd put to one side. Anyway, I had a bag of 18 mil pop-ups that I never used. Mm. I kid you not, I probably had a 3-egg mix of 18 mil pop-ups with this What's It flavouring that were too big for what I wanted, really, you know. And a mate of mine came round the house one day, and we were in the shed, and he sees his bag of pop-ups. I tell you who it was, Christoph. You probably know Christoph.
Yeah.
And he says, I'm going to France for a week. It's like a Carp Society kids fishing. Can I take that bag of pop-ups? I says, well, yeah, you can. I says, but bring them back if you don't use them, right? Don't throw them away. I says, because that's my winter pop, I use them for my winter pop-ups. And, you know, I says, they're a little bit big for what I want. I says, but I will probably get around to using them, you know. Now, cut a long story short, he went for a week's holiday in France with this bag of pop-ups. Someone supplied all the bait for these kids for the week. And anyway, after three days, everyone's struggling. They ain't had a bite. Yeah, they've all fired out all this bait and not had a bite. Anyway, Christoph decides to put a couple of my pop-ups on his rods, like, you know. No, he's cast them out. Hour later, he gets a run. Gets that in. Half hour later, gets a run on the other rod. Gets that in. Now, you know what kids are like. Oh, what'd you catch on? Oh, these pop-ups. You know, have a couple. Try it. You know, so anyway, by the end of the week, everyone is using these pop-ups and they're all catching carp on them. Like, you know, so it just shows you know, some, I don't know, certain flavours seem to, you know, as a singular baits, just seem to work really well, you know. And it was one, like I say, one of them baits that, I don't know, you'd struggle to catch using it at normal levels, but using it sort of 5 times a level as a single up bait, it worked wonders, you know. I could never get my head around that one, but.
Well, Frank was talking similar levels to what you're saying. He was talking 50, 70. Mil,
yeah.
And I've never heard anyone else say that until you've just sort of recounted similar stories to what he was saying. It sounds so crazy, doesn't it, using flavour levels that strong, but as you said, the carp are not eating them.
That's it.
So
you know, in my opinion, you don't know how what a carp thinks. Obviously, they're swimming around, and they're sort of like through their normal breathing through their nostrils and mouth, and that they're sort of like sampling the water as such, you know. And obviously, they're picking up. Hold on, I can smell something here. And they're drawn to the bait, and obviously, by that flavour or additive that you're using. And if there's only one bait there for them to pick up, they're going to pick it up. If it was like a normal bottom bait situation, they might spit it out. Think, oh, don't want that. But they are drawn to actually sampling it, and they've only got a pair of lips and a mouth. They ain't got hands like me and you. So, one bait, one rig, and next thing you know, your bobbins are flying. And it's only through. I mean, Frank's the same. I think Tim Childs he's done the same, similar sort of thing. You pick up these little confidence tricks, and you sort of once you realise it works, you can then use it to your advantage.
Yeah, of course, and it's so off the wall that until you've done it, it's probably people listening to this saying, I'm not going to put 70 mil of flavouring in me pop-up mix. But if you've done it, for whatever reason, I mean, a lot of the things Frank was talking about were accidents, he's had cock-ups with making bait and whatever, and then you catch on it and all of a sudden it's like, wow, and you've got something that no one else is doing. You've got something that's completely different.
Yeah.
And as we know,
obviously, you've heard of butyric acid. Now, I have used it a few times. It's sort of like divorce material, isn't it? It stinks it stinks like crap. It's a weird, horrible smell, But I've known people, when I've used it at sensible levels, right, I've known people to use it like 5 mil in a one egg mix. Now normally all you'd need is a couple of drops. It's that strong, if you try to make a one egg mix with 5 mil of butyric acid, the eggs will turn, so it won't bind properly. So you'll only end up, so you'll be sort of open, you'll get 50-60 hook baits, but it won't, it sort of like kills the egg and it won't roll properly, so you might end up getting like 10 or 12 baits when you're really open, you're going to get 50-60 baits. But I know people that have used butyric acid at like I say, silly levels, and of course, obviously as a single hook bait. I tend to sort of steer away from butyric acid because it is like bloody divorce material. Having said that, years ago I come up with a flavour combination. I used to call it the hauler. And it was squid and octopus, monster crab, and a few other sort of amino products and a little bit of protease, and it honestly, it stunk it to my heaven. I used to get it rolled by other, by bait rolling companies. So, obviously, when I first did it, I rolled it myself, when I was fishing airfield. Caught quite a lot of carp on it. This is, in like a fish meal base mix. My missus used to, fucking hell, that stinks. Go and wash your hands. She's always telling me, I can smell it, Even though you wash your hands, you can sort of still smell it. One of them sort of flavours, So in the end, I thought, I don't know what I'll do. I'll get some of these bait rolling firms to roll it for me. So I used to ship it out, get 50 or 100 kilos rolled by Johnny Bevan or Chilton Bait Rolling Services and fill up the freezer with it. And then I used to make like a one egg mix paste and just take the paste, in a bit of cling film with me and just do, like corkboard pop-ups on the bank, so my missus never had to really sort of smell it, so I tried microwaving it once and that was that was the last time I ever used
the microwave
flavour in the house again, And it was almost like, actually, I want a divorce, like, you know.
Do you still make your own bait these days? Yeah. Do you? What are you doing?
Well, I do and I don't. I mean, every year I probably do a couple of one-egg mixes. I've got two or three mates that are quite happy to make little batches for me, you know?
Yeah.
So I tend to get them to do it. I mean, I've got one mate, he's not married, he lives at home on his own, so he ain't worried about spending his kitchen out or whatever, you know? So I tend to get a mate to do it for me, really.
There's definitely a satisfaction in catching on your own bait, isn't there, that you do, that you've
sort of made. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't worry. I mean, to be honest, I mean, I'm not with Richworth anymore, but when I was with Richworth, I'm quite happy just to use straight off the shelf, out of the factory. Just it's exactly the same as what you buy in the shops.
Yeah.
You know, and if I can catch on it, I'm happy using that, you know. And I think the last... Well, I haven't used Richworth for a year or two now. So, but when I was using their Accelerate bait, and that's just sort of, I can only describe it. It smells a bit like pepperami, and I just, you know, exactly the same as what you buy out of shops, and I was catching on it, so I was happy using that. You know, all right, you do get satisfaction from rolling your own bait and developing your own baits and that, but. I'm quite happy, you know, if someone got a ready-made boilie in front of me and I'll go out and catch fish on it, I'm just as happy using it, to be honest, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of good baits around now, you know, there's a lot of good companies, but as I always remember, I mean, I used to make, mainly for price, you know, because bait was expensive, especially when you were young, you know, money wasn't about, so, you know, I'd do a six egg mix before I went fishing, but it was all part of the session, wasn't it? You know, a day or two before you go, or sometimes even on the day if you had to, you know, I'd make that six egg mix up. And but that's what I'm saying, like, nobody apart from obviously the serious guys that were probably doing big loads of it, but your average guy who had a little gardener boilie roller that made 10 baits at a time, you know, and nobody was going fishing with more than a six egg mix, you know, the majority of people, I'm sure, they were the heavy baiters of the day, but that was it, you know, you took a six egg mix fishing, which was, you know, probably a pound and a half, wasn't it, at the most, not even a kilo. And that was your bait for the session, and you'd put the rest in before you left, and that'd be it till you went again. So it just goes to show now, you know, a 5 kilo bag standard in most people's swims these days, and that's going in, and sometimes more.
It is amazing to hear what other anglers use and read what other anglers use in terms of quantity, and it's always, I don't know. I mean, I won't, without naming names, you know yourself, it's probably, you know, blokes that will think nothing of putting 10 kilos of bait out just to start the session off, you know, and, well, I'm not like that. I've never felt the need to put 10 kilos of bait out on, you know, before I've even cast my bloody rods out, you know. Even on Elstow, back in the day when Elstow had a real good head of big fish in it, you know, it had sort of like, I don't know, 15-40s and 50-30s.
Yeah.
Now, all right, you could have a situation where you might have 20 carp, say, move into your swim and start feeding on you all at the same time. Now, if you've got 20 carp and half of them are over 30 pounds, yeah, they will eat a couple of kilos in an hour, quite easily, you know. But I'm the sort of bloke that I'd rather, you know, even like, say, Elstow, where you've got a big head of big fish, I'm 2 kilos is about all I start off with. You know, and I'll only top up as and when I get a few bites. You know, if I don't get a bite, then I'm not going to put another 2 kilo out the next day. up at maybe half that amount now. So if I've had no bites in 48 hours, I've only put 3 kilos of bait out. Now, again, 3 kilos might sound a lot to some people, but it's all relevant to where you're fishing, you know. You know, if you're only fishing a little lake and there's only a couple of 30s in the entire lake, then chances are you're never going to encounter a situation where you've got every carp in the lake feeding on your patch of bait. So, one lake I fish called Summerlees. How can I describe it? It's say 50 acres of gravel pit, and there was only 18 carp in there.
Yeah.
Now, you was never going to get a situation where every single carp would turn up on your spot. It would never happen. But I can remember some blokes literally turning up on Summerlees and putting out like 3 buckets of particles out and 5 kilos of boilies and then fishing on it, thinking, well, blimey, do your sums. If you had 3 carp turn up on your bait, it's going to take them 2 days to eat that lot.
And that's the most likely scenario. You get a group of 2 or 3. You know, cross over at one point. You want to give yourself the best opportunity you can of hooking one of them fish, don't you, when it comes
that's
over?
Right, yeah. You're there to try and get a bite, not to actually, you know, physically feed them and then go home thinking, oh, that was a good session. No, I'm there to get a bite, and on a lake that's, you know, only got 18 carp in 50 acres, my philosophy was if I could manage to get one bite every time I fished there, I was doing well. But when I fished it, I was literally, I'd get me mark, you know, I used to fish four rods on that lake, and I used to fish, get 2 markers out, cast me 2 hook baits, or, you know, go out in a boat and sort of like check, everything's okay, you know, put on a clear area where you want to be fishing, whatever. And I used to fish probably about 3 or 4 handfuls of bait over each pair of rods. So in reality, I was probably only fishing, say, like no more than 100 boilies covering 2 rods. I used to literally put 4 rods out, and I used to put 200 boilies out.
Yeah.
And it was a case of, right, they're out there, I know they're fishing properly, you know, and I'm not going to reel those rods in for 48 hours. And it was weird. The longer I left the rods out, the more chance I was of getting a bite. And it was weird, you know, it's going through that mental block. Once you've done your gone 24, you know, you've cast out at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you go right away through the night, nothing, go right through the next morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, you're thinking, shall I reel in and recast and have it, you know, and put some more bait out? But if you could sit on your hands, this is what, you know, like I say, you have to do it to find out whether it works or not. If you could sit on your hands for another 24 hours, the second 24 hours was always the time to get a bite. And as a consequence of that, I fished Summerlees for, I think, 4 years. And I never done a great deal amount of time on there, but there was 1 year where I had one bite. I'd done about 12 48 hour sessions, and I had one bite. But I did catch half a dozen tench and half a dozen pike.
Yeah.
And I thought, right, well, if I can try something that stops catching pike and stops catching tench, I might stand a chance of catching a carp. And I come up with a rig called, I used to call it the Eliminator rig. And really, all it was imagine 2 boilies with a half-inch gap in between. The way I used to do that was, like, mount one boilie on the hair, you know, it's like a long hair. Mount a bit of dissolving foam, you know, the PVA nuggets. Put a PVA nugget on the hair first. And I used to mount a boilie on it, and I used to put another bit of PVA nugget on, then the second boilie. So he'd cast it out, and when you looked at it on the bottom, there was a gap between the baits.
Mm.
Now I'm sure pike, well, I don't know about pike, I think I was catching pike because I was using pop-ups, but then obviously I went, right, sod it, I'm just going to use double bottom baits. And I tried it with a gap in between, thinking, well, hopefully the tench will not pick me up. And as a well, it worked, a treat. And, you know, once I've had the confidence, well, once I caught a couple of carp using that eliminator rig, on my last season, you know, I've gone through 3 seasons and I've caught sort of like, well, 6 carp in 3 years. Not, doesn't sound a lot. Mm. But my last year that I fished it, I only fished it about 6 48-hour sessions.
Yeah.
And I had 4 carp and the one and only bream. You know, in sort of half the time of all the other years put together. You know, so, and that was, again, fishing over a handful of bait each time, whereas some of the other anglers were turning up and putting in buckets and buckets and buckets of bait, and I'm thinking, well, if that's the way you want to try and catch him, you carry on, because if you can't, you know, I don't know, I'm the sort of person, if I'll try something once, and if it don't work, I'll go, right, well, hold on a minute, that didn't work, so let's try something different. You know, you've got to, you know, if you're blanking and you're blanking and you're blanking, you've got to take a step back and go, hold on a minute, this ain't working. You know, some people can suss that sort of out and some people can't, you know, and that's probably why some anglers stand out from the rest. You know, they sort of like, they'll try various things and all of a sudden the penny will drop. It could be a rig, it could be a certain bait, it could be, the, you know, they've sussed out what the feeding time is, or it could be a whole number of things. And, you know, if you can't work out where you're going right and where you're going wrong, that's what makes a good angler and a bad angler, you know.
Definitely.
You've probably done the same yourself, Jamie. You know, you've probably gone somewhere, you've struggled, and all of a sudden, you've done something and it worked. And you've gone, right, I think I'm getting somewhere now. And then the next couple of times you go there, it's like you can't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
You know, everything seems to fall into place, you know.
Definitely, and I've done it on, you know, I've fished a lot of lakes, like you've just described, like Summerlees, where there's, you know, 20 carp or less. You know, Pit 2 was the same. I think there was about 17, 18 fishing where I fished there. You know, St. Ives was exactly the same, about 18, 20 fish. Yeah, I've fished a few places like that. And things become more important, I think, when you're fishing for less fish. You know, sightings become more important. And like I actually think when you get a chance, they're easier to catch on those sort of lakes, because there's different set of problems to... you know, fishing well stock lakes.
Yeah, they're only easy to catch once you've found that winning method,
yeah.
You know, or that winning bait on rig or whatever, you know. Like I say, it's easy to struggle until you find, you know, something that works, you know. It might be a slightly different tweak to a rig or something like that, you know. But it's the same thing with lakes that are heavily stocked, you know. Some people think they're doing okay. You think, hold on a minute. Catching one fish per 24 hours isn't really doing that well when some people are catching 4 fish per 24 hours.
Exactly.
You know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Some of these had that, was it that fantastic looking big plated carp that was on the front of Strictly Carp?
Yeah.
Was that some of these?
Yeah.
Is that fish?
Yeah,
I remember reading something recently you posted on Facebook. Is that fish still knocking about, did you say?
Yeah, it's still in there. Yeah, wow. Yeah, still in there.
Wow.
I mean, they were not. In fact, the sandy fish, which is the one everyone wanted to catch in there.
Oh.
I mean, when I fished there, there was the four. There was 4 known 40-pounders in there, and I had all of those. I think two of them I doubled up on twice. There was a fish called the sandy fish, which was definitely 50 pound plus. And that's still in there. So it's still, I mean, I don't know whether it's as big as what it was when I fished it back in sort of 2000, 2001. I mean, at the time I would have said it was probably about 55 pound.
Wow.
But yeah, that's still in there. But the lake's grown now. It's bigger. The lake's bigger now than what it was when I fished it.
Right.
There's that's more gravel out, and it's probably grown another five or ten acres. I also put some stockies in there as well. There's a lot more carp in there now.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, the stockies they put in, flipping hell, they're growing really quick. I mean, within 5 years, they were doing 30 pounders. You know, they're putting doubles. And within 5 years, they're doing 30 pounders. So there's probably more 30 pound carp in there now than what there's ever been, you know.
Wow. It shows how good an environment it was in the first place for them, you know, the low stock fish to get big.
The odd thing is, about half the lake you could see, you know, you should go over it in a boat. I mean, you was allowed to use boats, you know, with electric engines and what have you.
Mm.
And half the bottom you could see. And you struggle to see, I mean, obviously there's bloodworm in every lake, but you just sort of struggle to see any bloodworm beds. But what the lake had a lot of was snails. And I'm convinced that's why the carp are so big in there, because it was just so many snails in there, it was unreal.
Mm.
You know, quite big snails as well, you know.
Yeah, well, we know they like snails. I told you this would be the quickest 45 minute phone call you'd ever had. We've actually been an hour and a half currently.
Oh, blimey.
which we normally do about an hour, so I think there was loads more I wanted to talk to you about, but I think it's probably a good time to stop it. Maybe we can get you back on another occasion.
Yeah, well, if people that are listening to this podcast want to hear more from me, then get back to Jamie and I'll have another go.
Certainly, and if somebody wants,
it might be better if some of the people post a few questions up, and I can answer some sort of like random questions, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we do that. I'm looking at doing like a live stream when I do the recordings as well, so people can actually get in the chat box and ask questions in real time. So maybe we can have a look at doing that. In the meantime, if somebody wants to get hold of either Strictly Carp or your newer one, Heads Down Tails Up, where can they do that?
Well, Strictly Carp, that's only available from Bounty Hunter Publications. That's Rob Maiden's Big Carp magazine.
Yeah.
Set up. And for Heads Down, Tails Up, I think probably better off Googling it. And there might be a local tackle shop near you that does it. It's www.carmproductions.com, I think.
Yeah, Calm Productions. Yeah,
get it on Amazon do it, Tackle Box do it, Johnson Ross do it, Browns in Leighton Buzzard do it. I don't think there's any shops up north.
No.
There's an idea, Jamie, put this one to your punters. How about having me up on this northern show?
Yeah,
do a live stream up on there.
Yeah, that's not a bad shout. We're trying to put together a little book stand, actually, and for some reason Calm Productions, they do most of the shows, and they don't do probably the biggest. We're going to be the biggest show in the country by this year, certainly. We had 10,000 people last year, so, but for some reason Calm have never been up north. But it's
I'll have a word, because Oz Holness has got a new book out this year.
That's right.
And that seems to have sold really well at Sandown, so I'm sure Oz would be interested in doing a podcast and maybe coming up to the Northern Show.
Yeah, Oz actually did a podcast a few weeks ago, actually. He's already done the podcast, and I'm not sure if we've been speaking to him about the Northern Show or not, but yeah, it'd be great for Calm Productions to get up with a few of you guys. If not, I was looking at organising like a book corner, like in the catering area. We've got a huge catering area this year with a bar and stuff, and maybe putting a book corner in there where people can come and chat to people that have got books out like yourself, get the book signed, ask a few questions, you know, and maybe have a flick through it.
Well, you know me, Jamie. I ain't one for holding back any secrets. We're all on this planet just the once, and at the end of the day, if I make a few friends and help a few people out, that's all I'm worried about, really. You know.
Fantastic.
When I'm dead and buried, as long as people remember me as an approachable person that's willing to help most people out. You know what I mean?
Well, let's hope you're not dead and buried for quite some time to go. Yeah, there's plenty more carp to be caught out there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I want to catch a few more before I go, so, yeah, hopefully I've got a few more years left in me.
Well, thank you for talking to us on the Carpcast, and hopefully we'll see you in Manchester in April.
All right, Jamie. Nice one, mate. Nice talking to you.
Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under The Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course.
And a big thank you to Martin. As ever, we wish him all the best. Hopefully to see him out on the bank fishing again soon, fully recovered. Yeah, life's too short. Do not waste any of it. Who knows? I mean, all I was thinking during that interview is, could easily be me. You know, I'm mid-40s. And, you know, Martin felt fine before it happened, the heart attack. So, you can't be too careful. Who knows what's around the corner? So, let's make the most of it. Just one more thing then, before we knock this on the head. I had a message from Ian McMillan. He's got Simon Crowe on as a slideshow in Stoke. It's on February the 18th, and all proceeds are going to the hospice that cared for Jan Porter in his last days with us. It's going to be a two-part show with trade stands and a huge charity raffle at the end of the night. There's a Facebook page called A Night of Carp with Simon Crowe. It's all in aid of a great cause, obviously legendary. Jan Porter, the man in red who's no longer with us, all proceeds to the hospice there. So it's a great cause if you're anywhere near Stoke. 18th of February is the date. Get yourself over to A Night of Carp with Simon Crowe on Facebook, and you can get details of where you can pick tickets up from. They're only a tenner each, but it should be a good night out, a bit of a social, and all for a good cause. So until then, that's it from us, and we'll see you next time.
www.thecarpcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise, and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.